And now the next exciting episode of our summer movie series with an explosion and a little advice for any would-be hackers out there. Do not challenge a super secret computer to play anything other than chess.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
From War Games, of course, 25 years ago. That's right, the bomb, the plot device that can serve almost any function in almost any type of movie, from terrifying catalyst to deus ex machina. When movies went nuclear, they took us through every genre, every apocalypse, pre and post, and every nightmare scenario that made us duck and cover. What nuclear nightmares kept you up at night? Giant bugs, plutonium in your Kool-Aid, Colonel Bat Guano? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can send your nominees for best nuke flick to our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. As always, we're joined in Studio 3A by our cinematic guide, Murray Megaton Horowitz, the director and COO of the American Film Institute's Silver Theater and Cultural Center, which is here in the Washington, D.C. area. Murray, nice to have you back in the studio.
Thank you. Good to be here. It's much better looking at you, Neil.
Oh, well, thanks very much for that. The first movies after World War II, about the perils of radiation.
That's right. And it, you know, I think for the first time, people sort of got the idea that the absolute destruction of the entire world of life as we knew it was possible. I mean, they'd seen what had happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so it became a, I mean, this is going to sound like trivializing it, but it really did become a kind of convenient metaphor. I mean, we are all human beings, after all, living in the shadow of death, and the bomb makes it more proximate. So it was really a good plot device. I must say, as we look through these the list of movies, there's somebody I always consult in addition to my colleagues at AFI, which is my son Alex, a filmmaker. He said, "Dad, you know, this would have been a lot easier to narrow down if nuclear films didn't describe half the motion pictures ever made since World War II."
It's true. But there's an astonishing range of these pictures. I mean, from there's essentially monster movies, there's
right.
Apocalypse movies, there's thrillers.
That's right. And also a great artistic range. I mean, you've got Oscar caliber movies like Dr. Strangelove and Blue Sky, which won an Oscar for Jessica Lange, Hiroshima Mon Amour, down to, you know, The Amazing Colossal Man and Attack of the Crab Monsters and things like that.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Rosie's on the line. Rosie calling us from Minocqua in Wisconsin.
Hi, fellas. Just wanted to say, since you mentioned in the prelude the Godzilla, is there nothing better than the Godzilla movie with the baby Godzilla blowing the smoke rings while he's trying to learn how to blow fire?
Well, that's not the original, but the Godzilla, you know, the original Godzilla is looked on as a campy, scary monster movie, but the 1954 Japanese original is more than just screams, but there are a lot of screams.
That's right.
And Murray, American viewers wonder, how did Perry Mason get in this
right,
movie?
That's right. Well, that's Gojira, as I guess we're bound to call it. I mean, I don't know, Rosie. I think the original Godzilla, if you've not seen it, without Raymond Burr, who was later sliced into it by American distributors, is really quite something. I mean, it's a very, very good movie. It's a very eloquent movie, even though, you know, a lot of it was done on the cheap. It's one of those movies that falls into the category of the effects of the bomb. I mean, there is, as you said, Neil, the bomb in the background, the bomb as threat, the effects of the bomb, and then there are films about nuclear power, which is a whole other thing. But, you know, we got to specify, and these are the ground rules, folks. We're not talking about post-apocalypse movies like, you know, Mad Max, right, or A Boy and His Dog. We're talking about things that really have to do with when the bomb hits.
I like Boy and His Dog a lot.
Oh, they're great movies.
All right. Great last line. Rosie, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, guys. Love the show.
Oh, thank you very much for that.
Bye.
Let's see if we can go now to Dean. And Dean's with us from Nashville in Tennessee.
Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I actually am a college professor in American Studies and English Literature, and I teach a couple of classes that deal directly with this genre of films in one way or another.
Really?
And matter of fact, over the summer, I just taught a class on the atomic age and showed my students, Gojira, they weren't even familiar with the American version of Godzilla, but when I showed them Gojira, they really could see how it was a direct response to the Japanese experience of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, well, it just shows how far the cultural literacy of young people in America has descended if they don't know Raymond Burr and Godzilla.
Oh, yeah, what can I say?
Absolutely.
Well, what's your favorite, Dean?
Well, if I had to pick one, I would pick The War Game, which is not used with War Games, the Matthew Broderick film. The War Game was a documentary, and we should put that word in quotes, that was directed by Peter Watkins at the BBC.
And we have a clip from War Game. It was easy to play on people's fears of nuclear attack. The War Game is a fictional worst-case scenario docudrama sort of about nuclear war and its aftermath in and around a typical English city.
Rochester in Kent. Now 2 square miles of fire resulting from the heat of a thermonuclear missile which has exploded off course on its path to London Airport.
And Dean, as I remember, the scenario in the War Game was something's gone terribly wrong in Vietnam, and it escalates to nuclear war.
Well, it's actually in the Middle East, or if I'm not mistaken, and you know it's that typical scenario where there's some sort of geopolitical tension that rises to an insurmountable level. But what's really remarkable about this film is that it looks to be a documentary, and it's got that kind of. One of the things that makes it so chilling is that kind of neutral BBC narration.
Right.
And when Peter Watkins produced the film, he submitted it to the BBC, and they refused to show it. They thought it was unsuitable for the British audiences, and it remained unseen in Great Britain for 20 years, but he took it to the United States.
Yeah, it ran theatrically here, and I think, Neil, you saw it. I saw it in the theater.
I did, yeah.
It was terrifying, and to this day, I think it's the only fiction film ever to win the Oscar for Best Documentary.
Absolutely. It won the Oscar. I think in 1967, and it also...
65, it says here, but who knows?
I think it's
67.
But it also engendered two other kind of culturally significant films from the 80s, which was The Day After,
right.
Which generated the largest American television viewing audience in history to that point, 100 million viewers, and Threads, which was the British version, which makes The War Game look like a day in the park. The Threads is probably the single most terrifying nuclear war film ever made.
Okay.
So that there's a leap from in the 80s, there were a series of other really interesting and terrifying films in this genre that had directly to do with nuclear war, where it's not an analogy for something else, but actually the thing itself.
Dean, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thank you.
Here's an email we have from Peter in Dearborn. While there have been many films that have dealt directly with nuclear war, the only movie that acutely reflects the overwhelming paranoia of the time is Sidney Lumet's Failsafe. This film, without any music to speak of, takes a noirish approach to its subject that makes it all the more terrifying. Finally, Walter Matthau's portrayal of the morally and ethically flawed Professor Grotschelle may well be the very model that was adopted by Donald Rumsfeld. Both men are too smart for their own good, and the results are tragic for it all. We have a clip from Failsafe made in the same year as Dr. Strangelove, which is very strange. And basically the same scenario. One bomber gets through. There are no laughs, of course, in this picture. Here, President Henry Fonda tells his Soviet counterpart what will happen if Moscow does get nuked.
I've ordered a Vindicator bomber into the air from Washington. In a few minutes, it will be flying over New York City. It is carrying 2 20-megaton bombs. The moment I know that Moscow has been hit, I will order that plane to drop its bombs. It will use the Empire State Building for ground zero.
Turn of phrase that has taken on a whole new meaning
very
since
ominous
then. Yeah.
Thing. And it's an ominous film. I'm getting chills just remembering that film. It was directed by Sidney Lumet, another great American director. Two of them were busy at work that year, he and Stanley Kubrick. It features a screenplay. One of the reasons it's such a great movie, and you might remember it was revived for television about 25 years later, is that it was, or 35, it was written by Walter Bernstein, the great writer.
The great Walter Bernstein, and very spare. I mean, you think about that last scene. It's just there's barely any decoration on the set. It's just a cube with Henry Fonda. And who's the interpreter?
Oh, don't. Why did you ask this? I don't know.
All right.
Well, somebody will call in and let us
Google
know.
Google will let us know very quickly. Anyway, it's a great picture. There were, however, any number of films that were, well, less. They were kind of monster movies. We mentioned them. Radiation was in some ways as frightening as the fireball, and there was a sense that it was invisible and could create these terrible, terrible monsters.
The locusts are moving on the downtown area.
Get the other antenna! He's helpless without them!
Please, put me down!
Put her down! Put the girl down!
Those were locusts in The Beginning of the End, giant ants in Them, and a man over 50 feet tall wreaking havoc on Las Vegas in The Amazing Colossal Man.
And I have to tell you, especially with regard to The Amazing Colossal Man, folks, if you haven't seen this movie, don't bother to rent the original. Go get the Mystery Science Theater 3000 version of it, and perhaps of some of the others. I mean, you'll die laughing.
We're talking with Murray Horowitz, of course. It's our annual summer movie festival. We're talking about best nuke flicks today, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Russ, and Russ is on the line with us from Princeton in New Jersey.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
How you doing?
I think that the best nuclear movie by 100 megatons has to be Dr. Strangelove. Not only a great nuclear movie, but a masterpiece, period. Everything clicked in this movie. Great writing, great acting, great set design. The war room is incredible. And if the measure of a special movie is how many famous scenes it contains, this movie has more than I can count on all the fingers of Dr. Strangelove's hands.
And, of course, one of the things that clicked the best was Peter Sellers in multiple roles. Here he plays President Merkin Muffley, who places a call to the leader of the Soviet Union.
Now then, Dmitry, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dmitry. The hydrogen bomb.
It's the timing is impeccable. Russ, what can I tell you? When you're right, you're right. This to me is the best nuclear film of all time, and not least because it's darn near the only comedy in this genre. It's, if you can call it a genre, it's and it makes perfect sense in a way that after 20 years almost of the nuclear era and living under this awful threat, I did duck and cover exercises in my classroom in the second grade. What really becomes the best of all films is a comedy and a really vicious satire.
And George C. Scott as
George
the general.
C. Scott.
You know, 52 like that down on the deck. It's an amazing
if
thing.
He's really good. Yeah. If he's really good. And Scott always said that this was his favorite role. This he thought was his best performance, and I think he might be right.
You might be right. Russ, thanks very much for the call.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Gary. Gary with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
How you doing?
Very well,
doing
thank you.
Show.
Oh, thank you.
By the way, on Dr. Strangelove, one of the best scenes, you remember when Peter Sellers, when there was a fight, they said, no violence in here, this is the war room.
Gentlemen, no fighting in here, this is the war room.
No fighting in here. My favorite, and I still think the scariest, is the original On the Beach.
The terrific
movie.
On
the Devil's Shoot book.
Yeah.
From 51, I believe. And it was sort of a remake.
Here we have a pre-psycho Anthony Perkins convincing his wife to kill herself in the event of radiation sickness, which is going to be inevitable in this picture. And she has to give the pill to her baby daughter, too, Jennifer.
You're not trying to tell me you want me to kill Jennifer.
Mary, don't be an idiot. Supposing you get it first, what are you going to do then? Struggle on by yourself until you drop? Jenny might live for days and be sick and helpless in her crib with you dead on the floor beside her. Don't you see that? Don't you see it?
It's
an amazing, and the cast, you got Fred Astaire,
great cast.
You see the square in, I think it's Sydney, or I'm not sure, or Adelaide, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
And you just see the banner flapping in the wind, and the streets are totally deserted. You never see any violence, never see anybody die. It's just
and the heartbreaking scene when the American submarine goes back to the States to run down the radio signal. Maybe somebody's alive,
right?
And it's a Coke bottle.
A hot bottle pulling.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's terrifying. It's poignant. You're right. Neil has a great cast. Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner, a very important role for Fred Astaire in a completely non-dancing, serious role.
Right. He played the guy that was the driver, if I recall, crashed in that Max type thing.
And just an anecdote, on the way into the studio today, one of the younger producers on the NPR's Talk of the Nation staff said, I'm scared of the bomb now. I saw On the Beach. It's an amazing movie, and it is.
All right. Thanks, Gary.
She'd really read the book, though, too.
Thanks very much. Let's see if we can go to, let's go to Paul. Paul with us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I wanted to vote for the China Syndrome.
The nuclear power movie?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning nuclear power movies, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a – that's part of a genre that has to include a film also called Silkwood, where this is this is about a real person,
yeah.
Karen Silkwood, who was, poisoned with plutonium.
Oh, boy.
Now, come on, Karen, concentrate.
How did that plutonium get in my house?
Did you put it there?
Do you know what? What are you, crazy? Think I'm... You think I contaminate myself? You think I'd do that?
I think you'd do just about anything to hurt this company.
And that's scary in a number of ways, including, well, you know, the big villain, the big corporation.
Yeah, and a terrific film. It's by Mike Nichols. It's got Meryl Streep in one of her best roles. But also, Paul mentioned China Syndrome from 1979, also a good director, James Bridges. And what's interesting to me about that one is that Jane Fonda, who plays the reporter in China Syndrome, is she's trying to find alternate energy sources.
It's a little contemporary. Anyway, thank you very much for the call, Paul.
Thank you.
And Murray Horowitz, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Murray Horowitz, the director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center here in the Washington area. Tomorrow, Ira Flatow's here with Science Friday. We'll talk to you again on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is Talk of the Nation. Goodbye, Slim Pickens. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.